When Jesus had shown an interest in some tax collectors, people who were outcast from society in Matthew 9th chapter, his critics, who were constantly watching out for their own rules, said, "Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners?" When he heard it, he said, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. Go and learn what this means. I desire mercy and not sacrifice, for I came not to call the righteous, but sinners." That's one of two times in the Gospels that Jesus sends people back to the book of Hosea and says, in effect, go learn what Hosea meant when he said, "I desire mercy and not sacrifice," in this case. Hosea had learned in his own life something of the mercy of God. Mark Connelly's Green Pastures has the leading character learning that God is a God of love and not just a God of wrath. And when he was finally asked where he learned it, he said, where everybody else has to learn it, where Hosea learned it, through suffering. The suffering love of Hosea has become synonymous with any kind of contact with the book. The history of the period, we've gone through several times, but I suppose we have to go back and sort of pick it up again, because from Ezekiel and Daniel, who are during the Babylonian captivity in the 6th century B.C., we jump all the way back to the 8th century B.C. when we start what are called minor prophets. Minor in the sense that their books are shorter, and they're grouped together as the Book of the 12 at the end of the Old Testament, and Hosea starts that list. He mentions some kings in his opening paragraph, so that we're able to date him during the reign of Jeroboam II, who reigned in Israel up until his death in 746 B.C. The next 25 years, from 746 to 721, when that northern nation of 10 tribes went away into Assyrian captivity, never really to return as a group or as a nation, Israel, that northern nation, was ruled by 6 kings, 25 years, 4 different dynasties. Meaning that 4 kings out of the 6 were assassinated, and another was carried away into Assyrian captivity. It's a period in Israel's history when we're reminded very much of Latin American republics in our own time, or perhaps African nations in this decade. A very rapid change of rulers, a great deal of instability. When Tiglath-Pileser III, whose name in history is Pul, short, became king of Assyria, he began to exert his influence throughout the whole Fertile Crescent, which reached from the Persian Gulf around through Palestine and down to the tip of Egypt, with one aim. From all the way in the eastern part of that crescent, he was going to rule the whole thing. In 738 B.C., it became advisable for Menahem, one of those kings I mentioned in Israel, to pay tribute to him, and he did. In 735, another of those kings, Hoshea, joined with Syria, the nation immediately to Israel's north, and tried to force Judah, the southern part of the land of Israel, to go into a coalition with them to fight against Tiglath-Pileser. Against Isaiah's advice, the king of Judah went to Tiglath-Pileser instead, putting Judah, the southern kingdom, with Assyria, against Syria and the northern kingdom Israel. That, in effect, made the southern kingdom a vassal for a period of time. But when Tiglath-Pileser died, Hoshea, who was then king of Israel during this reign of a half dozen kings in very short order, decided it was time to rebel against Assyria's domination. He got encouragement from Egypt and staged his rebellion. And that only brought a siege against Israel. Shalmaneser followed Tiglath-Pileser. 5-year reign, and he came down and besieged Jerusalem. But he died during the siege, and it was left for Sargon, the next king of Assyria, to come in 721 and utterly destroy the northern nation as a people and carry them away into captivity. It's that kind of period of history. Any good Bible dictionary or study of the period will give the details. But Hosea watches the northern nation die, just as Jeremiah watched the southern nation die a little over a century after that. During this period of time, Hosea is called upon to engage in some symbolic actions, much like earlier prophets had done. One of God's ways of teaching Israel was to have the prophet go through a symbol which would bring out a lesson. Isaiah, you remember, walked on his bare feet through the city of Jerusalem, through its streets, in order to say to the people of Jerusalem, you're going to walk barefooted into captivity. You're going away into exile. You're going to suffer for your sins. Jeremiah put an iron yoke around his neck because Hananiah, one of the false prophets, had put a wooden yoke around his neck, indicating that if there is a captivity, it won't be any trouble to snap the yoke. We'll break it off. We'll be back in no time. Jeremiah put an iron yoke around his neck to say, you won't cast it off and you won't break it. You're going for a 70-year captivity. But I think of all the symbolic actions, Hosea had the most severe ones. He was told to go and marry a woman, a wanton woman, the New English Bible says. Other translations indicate that she was already an adulteress, though the Hebrew is uncertain at that point. The word, common word for prostitute, is not used. And so there are many who think that Gomer was only a woman who had latent tendencies toward unfaithfulness, which soon showed up and broke Hosea's heart, and that's the way the language should be understood. At any rate, with very difficult language, Hosea marries Gomer, and they have one child, and they name him Jezreel, because that's the valley where so many battles have been fought and where God had been asserting his supremacy, where Jehu had replaced the kingdom of Omri. It was sort of like saying Waterloo or Bunker Hill, some famous battleground, and Jezreel is the name of the boy. When the second child is born, there are indications that Hosea thinks the child isn't his. He names the child Lo-ruhamah, which means not pitied, or as the New English Bible gives it in a footnote, not loved. And as some have transliterated it, or rather given an expanded translation to it, she who never knew a father's love. Indications that Hosea thinks the daughter isn't his, that his wife is unfaithful to him. And he uses a name for her that God could well use for Israel, because Hosea is beginning to see that Israel is doing to God what Gomer is doing to him. And finally, when the third child is born, another daughter, he names her Lo-ami, not my people. A clearer indication yet that Hosea is saying, no kin of mine. And then Gomer seems to leave him entirely, with the three children to rear, and to go away after her lovers. And Hosea stays behind with a broken heart and tries to figure out the meaning of it all. In the midst of that, the book is written. The first three chapters dealing with his life, his family, the names of his children, the heartbreak he went through, even buying his wife back in chapter 3 as was read in the text. And the next 11 chapters, 4 through 14, are Hosea's preaching. A lot of ways to approach the book. I can't do it as I did Daniel, telling you one story out of each of the first six chapters where there are vivid illustrations of what the Israelites went through in captivity and what God did for them as they suffered in that captivity. Because chapters 4 through 14 have no such order that I can discover. One simply has to go through looking for Israel's contact with foreign nations. That's one of her main wrongs. For God's feeling toward her despite that contact and what he tries to do to get her to return. For Israel's sins, including idolatry, but also including massive injustice. And the one who goes through will be able to form something of an outline in the sense of major topics that are dealt with, but they're not dealt with in order. There are references all through the book to the problems. So what I like to do is take a little bit different approach and look at some truths about God that Hosea discovered in his own experience and through God's revelation to him, but truths that were borne out in what he experienced. The first one of those truths is that Hosea, seeing Israel doing to God what Gomer is doing to him, learns God's attitude toward men. He learns how God wants to relate to us. And that relationship is a relationship of love. In Hosea 11, verses 1 and 3 particularly, when Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. And a moment later, yet it was I who taught Ephraim to walk. Ephraim is the name of the largest tribe in the northern 10 tribes, so often the name Ephraim is used in Hosea to stand for Israel, the northern kingdom. It was I who taught Ephraim to walk. I took him up in my arms, but they did not know that I healed them. The desire of God to relate to Israel through love. When she was a child, I called her out of Egypt. Back in chapter 2, verses 5 and 8, there are a couple of other indications of God's love for Israel. For their mother has played the harlot. She that conceived them has acted shamefully. For she said, and Hosea is talking about Gomer now, I will go after my lovers who give me my bread and my water, my wool and my flax, my oil and my drink. And in verse 8, She did not know that it was I who gave her the grain, the wine, and the oil, and who lavished upon her silver and gold, which they used for Baal. Now, this is a truth about God that we take for granted intellectually, but we still have a lot of trouble internalizing. We tend to think of God in terms of fear, in terms of remoteness. And the Bible does talk of his anger, of his wrath, of his transcendence. But Hosea underlines for the first time so clearly in the Old Testament the fact that God is basically a God who wants to relate to his people in love. He uses a romance image. God went to Egypt when she was, or to Israel when she was in Egypt. Why didn't he go to the artistic Egyptians themselves? Why not go to the creative Phoenicians? Why not go to those talented Assyrians? Why Israel? But out of all the peoples of the earth, God loved her and went to Egypt and wooed her and brought her out to Sinai and made a covenant of marriage with her and then set her up in her own new home, a new land, Palestine. Can you tell me why you married your wife or your husband? Do you really know what drew you together? Can any two people really tell what it is that makes them love each other rather than someone else? Why does God choose Israel? It wasn't because she was great or powerful or because she deserved it, but God said it's because he loved her. And Hosea, as he began working through his own love for Gomer, which must have been unexplainable to him, why should he love a woman like this? Why should his heart be broken? Why not just turn to someone else or give up on marriage entirely? Instead, Hosea begins to understand what God's love is like because he knows what his love is like. When Jesus comes, he talks about the first and the great commandment, and he says, "You shall fear the Lord your God." Or did he? "You shall respect the Lord your God. You shall obey the Lord your God." Well, he taught all of that. But what he really said was the first commandment was, "You shall love the Lord your God." What God really wants is our love, and that entails our obedience. If you love me, you will keep my commandments. We love him because he first loved us, John says in 1 John 4:19. A truth that, once it ever gets through the veneer of ourselves, can transform our whole lives and our entire relationship with God. If we can ever see that God has a passion for us, that my companionship means something to him, that when I sin, I don't just break laws, I break his heart. I bring him pain and suffering because he loves and wants my companionship. Once I see that view of God, my relationship with him is never quite the same again. And that's one thing Hosea saw through his love for Gomer. I don't know if you've ever loved anyone like that. Does any one of us know whether he has until he's really tested? But through the test, Hosea learns what the heart of God must be like with faithless Israel. The second thing Hosea learns is that knowledge is related to the love of God in a way that perhaps he hadn't realized before, and knowledge is related to sin in a way that he hadn't realized before. In chapter 4, verse 6, for example, he says, "My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Because you've rejected knowledge, I reject you from being a priest to me. Since you've forgotten the law of your God, I also will forget your children." And a little later, verses 8 and 9, "They feed on the sin of my people. They're greedy for their iniquity, and they shall be like people, like priests. I will punish them for their ways and requite them for their deeds." Here is Israel in sin. She's unfaithful to God. What is the reason? How do you explain this? God has loved her. He's brought her out of Egypt, given her a land of her own, set her up with his blessings, and now she's turned her back on him and gone into prostitution to false gods. Why? Hosea says it's a lack of knowledge, and he blames both prophet and priest for the lack of knowledge of God's people. Think of the analogy between that and what Jesus found when he came. From the cross, he says, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." He's outside the city of Jerusalem in Luke 19, making that last visit into the city. Closing week of his life is at hand. And he says, as he weeps over the city, "If you had only known the things which belong to your peace," even now. If Jerusalem could realize even that moment what would bring her peace, and bow before God, that terrible destruction would not come a few decades later. But she doesn't know. He sat at the well in Samaria and said to the woman, if you knew who it is that said to you that he could give you the gift of God, this water, this living water, it would make such a change in her life if she only knew. But in his prayer in John 17, he said, because they do not know thee, the only true God. There is no knowledge of God in the world. So often the Bible makes knowledge, a lack of it, the reason for sin. I don't think the full import of this is seen if we just say, well, God has 10 laws here, and I didn't know about them, and so I've transgressed them. Knowledge is used in a deeper sense. It's used in the sense that Gomer doesn't know Hosea. If she really knew his heart, she wouldn't leave him and go after other lovers. She'd stay there under his love and care forever, but she didn't really know him. And so she decided other lovers have a great deal more to offer, so she went after them. So Israel is done with God. And it isn't just a matter of accumulating more factual knowledge about God. It's a matter of really coming to know him, to know him as a God of love, and to have this intimacy with him. And Hosea says that's the problem God's people have. They don't know him. The third thing that comes out in Hosea is again in chapter 11, beginning with verse 8. And that's God's deepest nature, his response when Israel sinned. How can I give you up, O Ephraim? How can I hand you over, O Israel? How can I make you like Admah? How can I treat you like Zeboim, cities that fell when Sodom and Gomorrah did? My heart recoils within me. My compassion grows warm and tender. I will not execute my fierce anger. I will not again destroy Ephraim, for I am God, not man, the Holy One in your midst, and I will not come to destroy. What do you do when a woman leaves home and goes after her lovers? I suppose superficially a person could say, well, doesn't matter, or refuse to admit it's going on, busy himself with something else and not face up to it. Or all the way at the other end of the continuum, he could explode and say, that's final, that's all of it, there's no hope, and break out in anger. God didn't do either one. He did not take Israel's sin lightly, nor did he say there's never any hope for Israel in the future. What he did was to say, Israel has sinned and Israel will suffer. She will go into exile, but I won't give up on her. How can I give thee up, O Ephraim? I'm going to win her back. I'll go to her in exile and woo her again for myself. God's deepest nature, again, tells us something about his relationship to us. Now, his nature didn't have to be that way. There's nothing in the universe that just decrees God must have a certain kind of nature. He loves because he wills to love. Nobody forced him to love. It becomes something that each of us ought to be thankful for. It seems to me that this is what the real life of the book of Hosea says, is that God's love is as deep and deeper than Hosea's, whose heart is broken by Gomer's unfaithfulness. That the real problem is that we don't know what God has to offer. We haven't appreciated it. We haven't had the relationship with it, or surely we wouldn't turn so easily away from it. But even when we turn away, God will not give up. He keeps pursuing. Now, there's another side to that. And that is that God will take our no. The terror of life is that God has made us free, moral beings, that we can say no and make it stick. We can refuse his love and companionship and be lost forever. That's the meaning of hell. The turning away from God that leads to eternal anguish and separation. Hosea, having loved Gomer, following God's deepest nature and wanting her back, in chapter 3 in the text, went down and bought her back with a homer and a lethic of barley. And then he said to her, you must dwell as mine for many days. You shall not play the harlot or belong to another man. So will I also be to you. If you can picture Hosea having one child by his wife, and then probably living with her while she has two children by somebody else, and then seeing her leave and go into adultery, perhaps as a temple prostitute, perhaps as a common prostitute, just leaving him for other lovers, and then having been abused and manipulated, finally she's sold into the slave market because she isn't worth anything to her lovers anymore. And Hosea learns about it and goes down to the marketplace and takes the price of a slave and says, I want her. And takes her home and says, you're going to be mine now. I bought you. You begin to get a feeling of what God feels for his children. I made you. I love you. I've bought you back. Will you be mine? It's that kind of divine love we hear every time a song is sung. Will you respond to it while we sing?